If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. If you think of 20th century Berlin, there are probably a few images that spring to mind. Some will think of seductive cabarets, brimming with artists and creative minds that shook up the Weimar era. Others may picture a city in ruins in 1945, decimated by battle and fearful of approaching armies. Or you might think of the Berlin Wall, a concrete scar that separated the city into east and west, and how it was torn down in 1989. Now imagine, as a Berliner, what it would have been like to live through all of this. And that's the concept at the centre of Sinclair McKay's new book, Berlin, Life and Loss in the City That Shaped the Century. He joined Ellen Evans recently to talk about the city's century of tumultuous history.
We're talking today about your latest book, which is Berlin, Life and Loss in the City That Shaped the Century. Could you introduce listeners to your approach to the history of the city and its inhabitants in the 20th century?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Berlin in the 20th century, in many ways, kind of shaped the 20th century. Not only in terms of the cataclysmic events of the fall of 1945, but also in terms of art, culture, science. And what I wanted to do was approach it from the point of view, say, if you had been born in the year 1900 in Berlin, imagine. And you were lucky enough to live through to your sort of 70s, your 80s, even your 90s. If you were born in Berlin at that time, you would then go on to live through an extraordinary series of revolutions and kind of violent upheavals. You have the Great War and the cataclysmic end of the Great War, which brought disease and violence and near-civil war to the streets of Berlin with the German Revolution. Then you have the Weimar Republic and the vertiginous swoops of economic disaster, cataclysmics of a depression, but also a city finding a whole new radiance, a city suddenly bathed in light, a city kind of exultant in its new artistic creativity in terms of cinema, theatre, cabaret. But then you have the 1930s, the rise of the Nazis, the psychosis of genocide, and then the fires of war. And then after that, you have a city rent in two by the competing ideologies of the Americans and the Soviets. And the city then becomes the potential flashpoint for a nuclear Third World War. And this kind of terrible neurotic tension lasts until 1989, when we have the breach of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And finally, for Berliners, a semblance of some peace and security and stability. So yes, the approach of the book was to try and take it very much from the point of view of the lives of ordinary Berliners, what it was like to live and work and love in a city which was just consistently in a state of kind of terrible kind of uproar and insecurity.
Yes, it is an incredible span of history and one ripe for such an account. And I can hear in your voice, obviously, it's such a special place for you as well. What's your relationship with the city and its history?
Well, this book in some ways is a follow-on from... I did a book a few years ago about Dresden and the bombing of Dresden in 1945. And during the course of the research for that, as so many thousands, countless people have before me, completely fell in love with Dresden. And as I say, again, the extraordinary accounts left behind by its ordinary citizens. And the approach with Berlin is very similar. There's a fantastic history group there called the Contemporary Witness Exchange, which over the last few years has been bringing Berliners together, particularly older Berliners, and capturing their voices, capturing their memories, and capturing the memories of their parents before them, so that their stories are kind of told and preserved properly. The fascination also with Berlin is that in the years after the war, and particularly in the shadow of genocide, there were a lot of Berliners who were reluctant to speak too openly about the traumas that they and their families have been through in the war, because they could not presume to tell the world that they too had suffered atrociously when after the horror that had been visited upon the Jewish population. But it left this kind of historical dark matter, this kind of gap, and the Contemporary Witness Exchange have been brilliant in just filling in those gaps, just collecting as many voices as possible, just to give us, not just to talk about the trauma of the war and of 1945, but also to talk about the early years of the Cold War, the texture and flavour of life, the films that people were enjoying, the games that children played, all the little details that add up to a much, much more complete kind of vision of the city. So that's, in a sense, kind of what drew me in. The Contemporary Witness Exchange is run by these volunteers, basically, brilliant academics. And they've got a fantastic website, too, which I recommend everyone to go to. But yes, that's what kind of drew me in.
Wonderful. Well, I imagine some listeners are going to be going rushing to Google that after this. So you write then about the city's unshockable spirit. And I wonder if we can sort of start there. It's got a real sort of... bold history. There are very, very bold aspects of its history and this sort of unshockable nature. What do you mean by that?
Well, yes. I mean, it emerges particularly in the period after the Great War, but after the failed German Revolution, this amazing cultural contrariness that breaks out all over the city. It becomes this kind of incredible crucible of both ideas and tolerance, too, way, way ahead of its time. It was an enormously cosmopolitan city from the 1920s onwards. It drew in immigrants from all over the continent, all over the world. All sorts of different communities found a very kind of welcome home in Berlin. And on top of that, there was an extraordinary kind of pioneering approach to sexuality, too. The homosexuality was still covered, I think, by called paragraph 175 in the German penal code. But matters such as homosexuality were explored with much, much more interest in Berlin, and people were much more free to live as they most truly were, without being persecuted or hounded. There was a very pioneering research institute, the Institute for Sexual Research, headed up by Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld, which did some amazing work certainly for its time, and way ahead of all kind of other European capitals. On top of that, you have this fantastic artistic scene, people like George Grosz and Otto Dix, and this fantastic kind of burgeoning artistic movement, which was produced fantastically sort of shocking art. And on top of that, you have a film industry. Now, this is, of course, at the time when film was still silent. And for the German film industry, this was an enormous boon because it meant that their films could be sort of completely sort of international in terms of... So the birth of cinema as an art form really comes in Berlin, in the studios, in its suburbs, the cabinet of Dr. Caligari, the Fritz Lang epics involving Siegfried and dragons, Metropolis, his amazing visionary science fiction film from 1926, which in turn, rather darkly, partly inspired Albert Speer, Hitler's architect, and Hitler himself. And you, this film industry produces extraordinary stars who then went off to Hollywood. And among them actually was the director Billy Wilder, who started his career in Berlin. The very witty film called People on Sunday, which is basically a comedy drama about four young people mucking about vaguely romantically in Berlin in 1930. And even to watch that film now, there's not a trace of a swastika to be seen. There are no street fights to be seen. There are no of communists versus Nazis. It appears to be, in 1930, a city at ease with itself. And that is a curiously kind of haunting thing in its own way. So yes, and on top of that, it's Einstein's city in the 1920s. You have the extraordinary scientific innovation going on in Berlin. The Lise Meitner and quantum physics and the exploration of nuclear, the possibility of nuclear kind of physics. So yes, Berlin in the 1920s, you see this kind of explosion of both creativity and openness and inclusiveness. And then the great fundamental mystery is how then the darkness could have crept over it so quickly and so completely. The philologist Victor Klemperer, who was himself Jewish, said that Berlin had always been characterized by its kind of contrariness and by its wit. And he thought that of all the places in Germany, the Nazism couldn't possibly have settled there, he thought. It seemed kind of impossibility, which makes the enigma of what happened over the years that followed even more kind of haunting.
And there are a number of catalyst events during this rise of Nazism in this period that I'm sure listeners will have come across before, the burning of the Reichstag and so on. So Berlin is inextricably tied up in this period. Can you take us more into the city during the rise in the early 1930s?
Yes. Well, what the Nazis did, as well as beginning very, very quickly the persecution of Jews and Romani people and gay people, it also kind of inverted the city's previous strengths. So I mentioned cinema and I mentioned art. What the Nazis did was that they turned that round. So the streets started fluttering with swastikas, but they were still being filmed because the Nazis were very aware of film as a medium which could capture kind of hearts and souls. And so the cameras were turned on Berlin, but now Nazi Berlin. And the city in some ways was staged as kind of a Nazi kind of film set. And it also led to outbreaks like the famous exhibition of degenerate art. So all those brilliant artists from the 1920s who had forged such kind of, were now demonized and more traditionalist artists took their place. And you also see it in terms of architecture. There's the fantastic creations of people like Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, who went on basically to create the American skyline of American skyscrapers. All of that was demonized too. So Nazi architecture fell into the hands of Albert Speer, a young architect who believed in a neoclassical vision. He started building a scale model of what his vision for a rebuilt Berlin, according to Hitler's orders. And this was a scale model in the Chancellery, which the two men would visit late at night, almost like a whispered secret between them. And it's a city dominated by these terrible, vast neoclassical structures and dominated by a vast dome of the People's Hall, which was 17 times bigger than the size of St. Peter's in Rome, I think. But it was a vision that was kind of fundamentally deathly. This was not a city for people, really. This was just a city of grandiloquent dreams. And so, yes, with the 1930s, the rise of the you had... I mean, Berlin, even after the Great War, had been quite a violent city as well. There had been endless kind of street fights, struggles. But this crystallised very much under the Nazis. The violence was brought into the kind of state realm, as it were, so as indeed was torture. And they took hold of the city. Again, the fundamental mystery here... Even at the very heart of Nazi Berlin, you see it on Kristallnacht, 1938, the terrible night where across Germany, the homes and businesses of Jewish people across the country were attacked ferociously, and Jewish people were murdered in the streets. It also, yes, I mean, there was also a terrible outbreak of it in Berlin. I mean, Kristallnacht happened as vehemently in Berlin as anywhere else. But there were other onlookers too, Gentile onlookers, who were horrified by this and confided to each other how horrified they were. They looked at their fellow Berliners who were taking part in these terrible kind of pogrom riots, and their immediate thought for a lot of Berliners was, how must this look to the outside world? What have we become? So even then, in the city, you have this kind of duality. The Nazis had complete dominion, but not quite complete dominion. They couldn't completely take over the imaginations of every single person. And in Berlin, of course, not everyone was a member of the Nazi Party. I mean, people had to be very careful about what they said, because all conversations were being monitored, telephone conversations were being monitored. But at the same time, there was still space in people's imaginations for other possibilities.
And despite this ideological resistance that is there, I mean, the horrors are inescapable. What did happen, as in much of Europe, to the Jewish population of Berlin at this time?
As I say, from 1933 onwards, the screw had been turning on the Jewish population of Berlin, as with everywhere else. You know, the Jewish people banned from cinemas, banned from certain parks, certainly banned from professions, banned from making livings, and also then banned from leaving the country. The oppression gathers and gathers and gathers. By 1941 in Berlin, the mass deportations to the death camps begin. And there are some extraordinary accounts of the terrible implacable, cruel bureaucracy of it. Elderly people being told that they've got an hour to pack one suitcase and then they were going to be taken to the railway station. And their neighbours in these houses, in these boarding houses, in these tenement blocks, kind of looking on but not daring to say a word, just listening to footsteps on stairwells. And the terrible spectacle of the elderly people being sort of taken, sitting on trucks and then being driven off to railway stations, and no one knew where they were going. As I say, there are some accounts now which are just absolutely sort of hair-raising, chilling, and kind of moving too, from Gentiles as well as Jewish people, sort of Gentiles kind of looking on at this. At the same time, there were a few instances in Berlin, stories which are absolutely extraordinary now to read, of the U-boats. These were Jewish people who became fugitives, who somehow managed to slip into the shadows and avoid these deportations and live a kind of completely underground, subterranean existence in the city, sort of denying their Jewish identity. And many of them helped by brave Gentile neighbours who had either given shelter in basements or helped them disguise their identities in other ways. So even then in Berlin, you still have this that fire of resistance never completely goes out. There's always that flame there, that they will not be sort of, totally and completely dominated.
So for the Jews who remained in Berlin then, for everyone who remained in Berlin, what can you say about the wartime experience living in Berlin? Is it fair to say that, I mean, the war completely changed the landscape of the city?
Yes, I mean, it changed it to the extent where you would emerge from a shelter into a morning that looked like night, because the sky was sort of dense with smoke. And a number of people would find it kind of impossible even to find certain neighbourhoods or districts, because the streets had been bombed so completely and so thoroughly that the districts were just completely deconstructed. I mean, the bombing of Berlin started, earlier on in the war, but by 1943 had an terrible, deadly, pulsating momentum where this night after night the city was being hit, just being reduced to rubble everywhere. And so basically from 1943 onwards, the Berliners, the civilian Berliners who were left in the city, were basically living this extraordinary, entombed, subterranean existence, either in specially built shelters or in brick basements or in these extraordinary flak towers, 200 feet high, made of concrete, but suggestive of kind of medieval fortresses. And night after night, they would listen to the endless booms and the thunderous kind of noise. And this somehow became life. And by 1945, as the Allied air forces were simply seeking to smash the city into the earth by the beginning of 1945. And so daily life became just the threads of human nature were stretched almost a snapping point. I mean, life simply became a matter of trying to get some sleep, but never being able to get sleep, emerging at dawn, queuing for hours and hours and hours for the dwindling supplies of rations that the authorities could provide. The authorities, by the spring of 1945, were telling people basically to grub up as many dandelions and weeds as they could to supplement their diets. Potatoes were incredibly difficult to come by. Meat was practically non-existent. The only possible consolation that was left was that there still seemed to be supplies of alcohol, but that was it. So by the spring of 1945, as the end of the war looms, Berliners have somehow adjusted to what must have already looked like doomsday.
And can we dig more into the sense of the Berliners that you discovered then? What are their feelings living in these bunkers, waiting for approaching armies?
Well, the overwhelming sense was just one of kind of the fear of the approaching armies, because remember, most of the people who were sheltering were women, because the men were all off fighting. So it was either women, children, or older people. And the rumours had come back to Berlin quite early on about what the Red Army was, the nature of the Red Army, this conquering force that was approaching from the east. Terrible stories of the mass rapes and murders in Pomerania and Silesia, and the stories were true. And the Berliners had the sense that there were a lot of Berliners who were, because American culture had been so pervasive in Berlin, even up until the 1930s, even with the Nazis. You know, these were Berliners who were used to the films of Laurel and Hardy and Gary Cooper. So they were familiar with the Americans. Even though the Americans were bombing the city, and even though the British were bombing the city, there were a lot of Berliners who were hoping somehow that the Americans would get there first, because they felt there was some kind of connection there. But they felt no connection with the Soviets at all. There was just simply brute fear. And as the Soviets started to encircle the city, and as they started to make their way to the suburbs, just with, you know, destroying block by block with artillery and tanks rolling down the street, the prospect for the women of Berlin was absolutely terrifying, and rightly so. Here was not just a conquering army, but a conquering army set on vengeance for all the atrocities that the Nazis had committed in the East. Something terrible and atavistic was coming. The vengeance is beyond human rationality, really. It just spoke to the deepest, darkest corners of human nature. And there was deep, dark fear as a result of that.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Even in the tightest of situations, like the Berlin blockade, there was a kind of porousness. And West Berliners, who were facing power cuts every night, could basically go up to the borderline of East Berlin and see the neon lights.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So it's very harrowing history, obviously, a very dark time in Berlin's history in the 20th century. And there's lots of it in the book. But if we'll move on to post-war, and you mentioned the various forces converging on Berlin in 1945, perhaps we can explain for listeners who might not be familiar with what happens then geopolitically, what happens to Berlin in these post-war years? How exactly do these forces work to divide up the city?
Well, yes. What happens in those post-war years is that sometime before, a couple of years before, the Allies, that's basically America, Britain, France and Russia, had discussed how Germany was going to be occupied and ruled after the war when victory came. And by 1945, Berlin itself had been demarcated into kind of four zones of occupation. The Americans, the British, the French, and the Russians, who would have the East, or the Soviets, who would have the East. It was the Russians who came in first, or should I say the Soviets, who made it to the city first. As a result, the Americans, the British, and the French didn't actually manage to get their forces into the city in terms of occupation and power until that summer of 1945. So the Russians basically had sort of a two-month, three-month kind of advantage where they basically not just the Soviets took over the city and imposed their own kind of the vision on it, but what then unfurled was incredibly complex on so many different levels. The city was then divided into the occupying powers, and each took their own zone of occupation, and they all kind of coexisted with each other. Even though the Soviet system was obviously in a different quantum realm from the American system or the British system. But in the middle of all this, we have the Berliners themselves, who have no real kind of agency of their own. And also, bear in mind, these are Berliners who had been through the unimaginable trauma of the events of 1945, the literally uncountable number of rapes and the repercussions, the family trauma that was continuing to echo through the city silently. But then you also have this other side with the Soviet occupation and the other powers too. The Soviets, as soon as they went in, were very keen to start restoring the tokens of normal life. They wanted to get the cinemas open again. They wanted to get the theatres open again. They particularly wanted to get the concert halls open again because they recognised that Berlin fundamentally had always been an intensely cultured city, and its people were intensely cultured. And the idea was to give them back the music that they had not had for those of the last few years, to give them back the film, the theatre. So there was a sort of duality in that Soviet approach. They were absolutely ruthless in imposing control on their part of the city. It's Walter Ulbricht was the communist who came in, himself a Berliner who had been a communist in the Reichstag in the 1920s and the 1930s, now returned to Berlin to basically take over it and the East Germany. So on the Soviet side, you have yes, this kind of this imposition of Soviet rule. On the American side and the British side of the city, you have suddenly these tokens of abundance. Suddenly the cocktail bars are open again, the cabarets are open again, but not to Berliners. They're open for Americans and for the British people, but not for Berliners. So it took a while before Berliners who were living in rubble still, who basically had very little access to proper food, to anything. But in terms of food, it was those post-war years were just absolutely harrowing for Berliners. The calorific intake for Berliners, something like 1,500 calories a day, which is way below what it should be, because it was very difficult to get supplies in. And the other thing that the Soviets did try to do, as well as the other occupying powers, was ensure that sort of those kind of supplies came through again. But it must have been extraordinary for Berliners themselves. Suddenly they were being occupied. Suddenly they were living their lives according to other people's rules. Once again, because to a lot of Berliners, Nazi rule had been alien, and now they were faced with this, plus the prospect of almost non-stop hunger from 1945, 46, even into 47. But then very gradually, absolutely extraordinarily, the city starts to regenerate and the people start to find their old spirit. As I say, the cabarets were very quick to reopen, and people flocked back to cinemas, not least because it was a much more comfortable place in many cases to be than home. At least you were in a kind of comfortable auditorium. And even if the films they were watching were the so-called rubble films, these were sort of thrillers and dramas filmed amid the rubble of Berlin. But it seemed somehow more comfortable to be watching it in the silvery darkness in artfully shot black and white than actually facing the reality of it outside. So, as I say, you have this extraordinary thing where you have over a million citizens in a state of trauma and near constant hunger. You have children who are going back to schools which are basically kind of the rubble themselves. And yet somehow a kind of sense of normality rebuilds and a sense of that old Berlin contrariness and wit starts to come through again. And the American film director, Billy Wilder, came back to Berlin in those post-war years. He was now a colonel in the US Army in a psychological unit. And his job was to use film to basically de-Nazify the population. That was the idea. And there were films about the Holocaust, documentaries about what had been done in the name of the Germans. And it was Billy Wilder who oversaw the films so that they would have a proper impact on the German people. But he also understood that there was certainly in Berlin, obviously a huge number of people did have to be denazified, as the phrase went, but there were also a huge number of people who were had never been totally Nazified in the first place. There's a film he made in 1947 set in Berlin called A Foreign Affair, which is extraordinary to watch now because it's all about the American army in Berlin in 1947. And it's about black marketeering. It's about sexual black marketeering in a sense, how sex is used for favors. It's a comedy, but it's as dark as midnight. And there's one extraordinary scene now where there's a father has had to take his little boy into the local police station because the little boy won't stop drawing swastikas in chalk on walls. And the father's saying, how do I get him to stop? How do I get him to stop? And the authorities say, it's fine, the little boy will grow out of it. And as the father gets up, we see that on his back, the little boy has drawn a chalk swastika on his back. To make those jokes in 1947 was an extraordinary thing. But it also kind of, there was an element of truth about it too, because underneath underneath the surface of Berlin, there was always this sense of defiant humour. The city was very much characterised by it. The Victor Klemperer, who I mentioned earlier, said that was one thing you could always count on Berliners for, was this the rough kind of redemptive kind of humour that kind of surfaced. So yes, you have the most extraordinary extremes in those post-war years as the occupying powers take over Berlin. Everything between sort of near famine, but also the return of art in the form of Bertolt Brecht, who came back to the city and founded a theatre company there. So the duality of the city continues.
And you mentioned agency and all the zones of the city rebuilding in the post-war years. How much agency then did Berliners have or could have in terms of moving between zones or resisting the ideologies that were perhaps being imposed? And how did that change then going into the later decades?
Well, going into the later decades, what happens in the 1950s is that the city becomes ever more bifurcated between the different zones. But this is pre the Berlin Wall. So it's perfectly possible for Berliners with the correct kind of papers and documentation to move freely between all the zones. You could be in Soviet communist East Berlin the one minute and capitalist decadent West Berlin the next. And yes, the Berliners are moving back and forth, not just for leisure, but also for work. You know, there were a number of Berliners living in East communist East Berlin who worked in West Berlin and who would shop in West Berlin. It was extraordinary that the city held within itself these sort of different quantum states. And the Berliners somehow managed to see a line of normality through it. But the tensions were always there. There was the famous Berlin blockade of 1948 to 1949, which partly arose as a result of currency conflicts. The Americans were introducing a new Reichsmark. The Soviets had their own currency. And so the Soviets blockaded the city. Berlin, it was basically a city, an island in a sea of red, because it's East Germany, of course, and East Germany was in the Soviet zone of the occupied Germany. And in the Berlin blockade, we have an image now of West Berlin being completely surrounded. There's absolutely no way in, no way out. The Soviets cut off the roads, the railways, the canals. And at the time, there was a real terror in West Berlin that this would lead to renewed famine. You know, how on earth were they going to get food? But actually, the situation was slightly more porous than that. And even this illustrates the slightly paradoxical nature of post-war Berlin. That even though the blockade was total, the Americans, the British, started this famous airlift that went on for months, an amazing operation where plane after plane after plane landing seconds after each other would bring in food, would bring in some fuel, would bring in toys for children, and became an extraordinary kind of spectacle in its own right. But while this was going on, in the Soviet sector, the communists were saying to people in West Berlin, look, there's still no wall. Why don't you come over? We've got huge amounts of supplies here. Can we tempt you with some of our supplies? We can feed you. Don't worry about these Americans, these British. We can make sure that you're all right. West Berliners absolutely withstood it and said no. Absolutely not. And I think it was said that about 5% of West Berliners took advantage of various Soviet offers of either food or fuel, because they were getting everything they needed from this brilliant, audacious airlift, which was kind of an international spectacle. But in terms of industry, it was still the case that a lot of the fuel for industry in West Berlin was coming from the Soviet sector. So even in the tightest of situations, like the Berlin blockade, there was a kind of porousness. And West Berliners, who were facing power cuts every night, could basically go up to the borderline of East Berlin and see the neon lights of the eastern city beyond. So it's throughout the 1950s then, what you start to see is, first of all, competition between East and West. In artistic terms, both East and West Berlin compete to get the best ballet dancers, the best opera singers, the most prestigious kind of arts festivals, all this kind of soft power stuff. But at the same time, the economy of East Berlin starts sagging, whereas West Berlin becomes richer and richer, and the inequalities between the two sides become ever more sort of glaringly apparent. In 1953, there was an uprising in East Berlin, as there was throughout East Germany. A workers' uprising because the Soviets were imposing too tight work rota production targets. which led to basically riots on the streets of East Berlin, which then the Soviet authorities said were being stoked up by the Americans and the CIA. So everything was about paranoia, everything was about crackling low-level hostility. And underneath all of this were the fears of the new Cold War in a new nuclear age, when both new superpowers were armed with nuclear weapons. And the eyes of the world became ever more fixed on Berlin throughout this period as one of the potential flashpoints for this new nuclear war. If it was going to spark anywhere, it was going to spark in Berlin because of the incompatibility of these two mighty geopolitical systems and that their tectonic plates kind of rubbing against each other. And by 1961, it simply became too much for the East Germans and the Soviet side to see so many people going from east to west across that open border in the city. There was one year when I think 200,000 people crossed over, among them doctors, architects, physicists, broadcasters, actors, basically some people. It was very difficult for the East German regime to lose. And the East German regime was in some serious economic trouble as a result. So in some desperation, the Berlin Wall came about as almost kind of extemporized, even though it was implacable at the same time. But what was also true is that when it started going up in August 1961, very, very quickly, the horror that rippled throughout the city was quite extraordinary.
And so then what does that mean for Berliners' sense of selves? I mean, I know the city was already divided into these zones, but how then is that sort of consolidated and how does that develop?
Well, yes, it's again, the East Berliners and West Berliners, they're all Berliners, but under these different powers. And where you fall in the city is, you know, largely a matter of luck. If you have to live in the east of the city beforehand, if your family happened to live in the east, you know, that was the system you were kind of left with. There were lots and lots of people who made determined efforts to get to the west of the city, not just because this was where it was more prosperous, but also that's because where a lot of family was. So the Berlin Wall, when it started materialising on the streets, was a terrible thing because it not only trapped people within their spheres, but it also sundered families, it sundered loved ones. Hence the desperate efforts of people to sneak through the final gaps as they were starting to be filled in. There were people who found mazy routes through kind of old cemeteries, as the courtyards and across rivers. Even then, it's fascinating to read the accounts of the people who were actually building the wall, the men who were actually making the concrete, kind of actually there on site, who said that they were kind of fueled with a combination of coffee and rum. He said a lot of them were sort of quite sloshed at the time. And it didn't occur to them that what they were doing was building something permanent. And it still didn't, and it didn't occur to them they were building something that would become part of the landscape of the world as a symbol of oppression and fear. So you have this then, this extraordinary, like a jagged scar running through the city. And in the earliest days of it, there were Berliners, particularly West Berliners, who get right up close to it, who actually sort of touched the Berlin Wall in some disbelief. They put their palms in the concrete. And there were others who could have paced beneath it incessantly in agitation and distress. They couldn't quite fathom how this had become the news of limit of their life. People standing on each other's shoulders, trying to get glimpses of relatives. You can see all this of the silent despair and just this, the disbelief of it. But then it became, you know, it settled. The concrete became part of the architecture of the city, mirroring, ironically, some of the brutalist concrete architecture that was being put up on both sides.
Do you think, then, that the fact that the Berlin Wall today is such a symbol linked with the Cold War division, the sort of the Iron Curtain, do we lose, then, the sense of what the wall actually meant physically and in reality for Berliners?
Well, I think no, because I think in Berlin they've been quite good actually There are certain sections of the Berlin Wall you can still find there that have been preserved almost of museum pieces. And they do give an extraordinary sense of what it must be like. Because the wall itself wasn't always completely unchanging. There's kind of fascinating sort of architectural quirk about it. They were continually kind of rebuilding it in various different styles with different sorts of improved concrete or different ways of making it incredibly difficult for people to scramble over the top. And there's a brilliant account from a man who was a guard on the East Berlin side, basically to ensure that no one got across the death strip. You know, the famous image is of this terrible zone in between walls where people try to get across and they're shot. And it's basically a zone of death. There was one East German guard who watched the rebuilding of the wall in the 1970s. They were giving it a new architectural style, which meant that not only could people not get across, but people couldn't ram it with cars or go at it with heavier vehicles and that. And he looked at it and he looked at it, and suddenly he realised, and his world turned upside down. He realised that this wall wasn't keeping the rapacious Americans out. This was keeping him in. And the reason he knew that is because he knew that on the other side, on the western side, on the free side, people could walk up to the wall and touch it. But he knew on his side, if anyone did that, they would be in terrible danger. And suddenly the way he looked at the wall completely flipped on its head. And if you take his story and then it kind of extrapolate that across an entire population of East Berlin, you see this, again, an extraordinary story of kind of that essentially contrary spirits of looking at things in a way different to the way the authorities would wish you to. But also this incredible endurance as well. Because as I say, by the 1980s, Berliners had been through almost a century of just this constant low-level anxiety and neurosis, and somehow managed to accommodate it within themselves and still persist with a certain kind of rebelliousness. It's lovely now to read the stories of young East Berliners who craved the pop music of the West, because they can hear it, the forbidden radio shows, but they can hear it coming from the other side of the wall. There was a rumour in 1969 that the Rolling Stones were going to play on top of a tower block in West Berlin, and East Berlin teenagers could rush to that part of the wall nearest to it. Where they thought, and of course, the Stasi authorities went absolutely mad, beat them back, and then the oppressions have set in. But it still raises the question, how on earth could the rumour have spread from the west to the east that this was going to happen in the first place? And then you also find it even up into the 1980s, where there are East Berliners who decided that punk rock was very much the way forward, an absolute defiance of the authorities, to the extent where the Stasi actually infiltrated an agent dressed up as a punk rocker himself in order to infiltrate one of these, you know, dangerous youth groups, who themselves were hand in hand with the Lutheran Church, which itself was a rebellion against the iron grey totalitarianism, that communist regime. And so all the way through the Berlin story, you see these brilliant outbreaks of nonconformity and defiance.
And given that defiance, then, what does that mean when the wall finally comes down? What does that mean for a sense of reunification of Berlin?
But that particular night is that you get the sense from a lot of accounts of just that, not just the disbelief that something which has seemed as if it would be there, rather like one of Albert Speer's creations for a thousand years, suddenly just instantly disappears. But totalitarianism disappears like a ghost. But for many Berliners, remember, 1989, though, for the older Berliners who had lived through the Nazi years and all the rest of it, this had been almost of 60 years of totalitarianism, which they had lived under, in one form or another, be it the Nazis or be it the communists. I suppose what it means is Berlin, the true soul of Berlin kind of reasserts itself, and reasserts itself very, very quickly, but it's almost as if the real soul of Berlin had never been that far away in the first place. It was always there, waiting. And obviously reunification brought its own, there were bumps and the tensions along the way. I mean, obviously there had to be, because the two opposing systems then suddenly meshed into each other, and all a million different mindsets to be changed. But think how quickly the Berliners emerged from Nazism. It was assumed by the occupying powers that they would have to be sort of deprogrammed in the most sort of careful scientific way because they'd be brainwashed. But actually, as it turned out, they didn't, because the Nazi hold on the Berlin imagination had never been that strong in the first place. And the same was certainly true of the East German government too. So the Berlin we see now, this city, you know, from the point of view of visitors, very much a city for sort of young people in a sense, because it's very artistic, it's very bohemian. You've got this extraordinary kind of nightclubs, you've got this extraordinary kind of rackety sense of kind of urban life. That's a Berlin that many of those Weimar artists of the 1920s would have had no difficulty in recognising at all. Said, ah, yeah, this is exactly the same city, with exactly the same kind of artistic vibe, exactly the same sense of kind of pioneering kind of exploration, and a real sort of relish in all the sensual delights of kind of human nature. Because that's the kind of real Berlin. For almost 100 years, the geopolitics conspired to give, it was almost like a boulder on a flower, but that flower remained kind of intact beneath the boulder. Remove the boulder and the flower is still there, open to the sunshine. I think that's the sense of Berlin, isn't it? That's what makes it so incredibly attractive to the international imagination still.
Was Sinclair McKay. Berlin, Life and Loss in the City That Shaped the Century, is out now, published by Penguin.
Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer Arden.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.